Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Danny's Diary, the podcast powered by Singing News Magazine. I am Danny Jones, and welcome. Our guest today is a legend from the world of Southern gospel music, Eddie Crook. Eddie, we're glad that you're with us.
It's always a pleasure, Danny.
All right, let's go back and talk about the long, illustrious career of Eddie Crook. Many people remember you from your days with such artists as the Happy Goodman Family, Seago Brothers, and Naomi, but your performing resume includes a few others as well.
Well, that is correct. I started playing with a quartet in high school called the Highlanders. They graduated, went off to college for a little while, played with a group in Nashville called the Gospel Heirs, sung on the Wally Fowler All Night Singing. Left them, went to Tennessee Tech University for a while, met some guys up there, wound up playing with a group called the Tennesseans. That lasted for a while. Left them, went to Baton Rouge, played with a quartet called the Plainsman Quartet, and backed up the Governor Jimmy Davis, and left them and came back to Nashville and had a short term with a country music guy, Marty Robbins, played in his band for about a year. Left him and then went with the Seago Brothers and Naomi, and that brings you up to where you were.
Okay. Now, as you can tell, Eddie has not been around the block just once. He's been around several times. So he's seen everything that you can possibly see in Southern gospel music. He's been there during some of the most exciting times of this genre. But in addition to his performing days, he's also recognized as someone who has helped to shape what you hear today in the world of gospel music. And he's done that through record producing predominantly. Eddie is the gentleman who brought to national attention such artists as the McCameys, the Isaacs, the Crab Family, Perry's, a lot of other groups that are household names today. At some point, they came through the doors of a company that was located
on Wren Road in Goodlettsville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's exactly right, right across the street from the Harper Agency.
Yeah, that's right.
Sort of gospel music mecca right there between the two buildings. And Eddie, you've expressed to me along the way that one of the great joys of your life was taking an artist who did not have a national following and develop that artist to be the best they could be. And those groups that we just named, that's just a short list of some of the people who've come through the Eddie Crook Company doors. But what would you feel are some of your producing highlights?
Well, there's so many. We had so many people that were in gospel music at that time, and radio being as big as it was, everybody was wanting a radio single. Actually, I was always on the lookout for good songs and felt like that if we had a singing group, if we could find the right song that would fit them, that perhaps that the audience would agree with us and would like it also, and then everyone would be successful. So mainly we were always looking for, and I don't know what we were looking for, but God just sent these people to our company that were maybe unknown singing groups that sung in their area. But inside their singing group, they had a songwriter that was singing and writing songs that would fit other people, we felt like. I give you an example. We did recorded a group from Savannah, Georgia called the Encouragers, the wife team of Dee and Danny Kramer, which I believe they're still active in some way or another. But anyway, they came and they recorded an album, and nobody had heard of the Encouragers before, but they had songs that they had written that really impressed me. So at about the same time, we were found this singing group up in Kentucky singing in a cow pasture on a flatbed truck called the Bishops. And they had some few years of singing together before they retired. And doing the Bishops, we were fortunate enough, they recorded with us and signed a pretty good term contract. So I'm on the hunt to find songs for the Bishops. And it just so happened that this Dee and Danny Kramer song, I listened to it and I said, that sounds like that would be a good song for the Bishops. And one of the songs I recall was He's in the Midst. And it became a big popular song for them. And that's kind of the way things worked. We were dealing with all kinds of singing groups from all parts of the country. And they would come in and they'd have a song or two songs or three songs. And maybe we would send out a single on them. But if there was a song that we really believed in strongly that would fit this other artist, we would kind of go there too.
And it was a proven successful strategy, if you will. It worked many, many times. Of course, the name Eddie Crook will forever be associated to some degree with another legendary name in gospel music, the McCameys. And it was Eddie's company that first took the McCameys to the national spotlight of Southern gospel music. Some great songs. Of course, you have to include on that list God on the Mountain, a live recording that was done in the late 1980s in Hendersonville, Tennessee. And that album, Gone to Meeting, went on to become one of the biggest selling albums ever in Southern gospel music. God on the Mountain is a classic song in Southern gospel music. Can you take us back to that time when preparations for that album were going on and then the success of God on the Mountain? Give us a quick snapshot of that window.
Well, we were already doing a lot of recordings, a lot of albums on the McCameys at by then. I mean, we already had some number one songs.
Right.
And they were doing quite well everywhere they were performing. I would like to take credit for a lot of that Gone to Meeting album, but I really cannot, because that was one of the times when the McCameys kind of came in with their own song lineup. And they weren't asking me for songs. I mean, they already had the songs kind of picked out. So I can't remember all of the songs, which God on the Mountain was such an enormous hit. It kind of dwarfed all the other songs on the album.
It did.
But they had their songs pretty well picked. And I don't believe anybody, though, expected that song to be what it turned out to be. I mean, when we did it that night, it was recorded in Hendersonville at what was then called Twitty City Auditorium, and had a big crowd. We had another group to record with us that night, a live album at the same time, called the Wilburns.
Right.
They did a live album the same night. But anyway, it was a big crowd, a lot of church people there, and when the McCameys did God on the Mountain, they sung the second verse of it. I'm not sure if that was what it was, but this lady in the audience kind of got happy, you know, and started shouting. I mean, maybe some of your audience doesn't understand what that is or don't know, but some of the people in some of the country churches, country Baptist churches, they get happy and they shout. And so we had shouting right in the middle of God on the Mountain. And when she did that, that got Peg even more happy, and she started getting more excited, and all of it together, and then they had to encore the song.
Right.
So at the end of it, we had a few rough places vocally. I remember the next day, maybe, I went with a man named Kevin McManus, who happened to be running the sound recording for me that night, and we listened to it. And it had a few rough places, so we brought a couple of the singers back in to kind of re-sing some of the harmony parts to smooth it up, but we didn't touch what Peg did. We left that alone. But after trimming it just a little bit, we, or at least I believe, we had a monster hit on our hands. And we did.
You did. And, you know, even though the McCamies retired from full-time touring just a few short weeks ago, that song was a song 20-plus years later, 30-plus years, actually, that they still had to sing every night. And very few groups can say they have a song that is part of their lineup every night. Let's go back even further. Let's go back to your days on the road. The Plainsmen, you know, a very well-respected quartet in the world of gospel music history, but they never quite got the attention of some of the other groups of that era. What was it about the Plainsmen that made them the good group that they were?
Well, they were very talented. Each individual that sung in the quartet, they were all very talented. I mean, the lead singer, Jack Maynard, for instance, mm-hmm. he could sing a solo, and he sounded like a country singer when he was singing a solo. The baritone singer, Howard Welborn, he had sung already with several groups, including the Chuckwagon Gang before with the Plainsmen. He was very smooth baritone, but could sing high tenor part if he needed to. And the tenor singer was just, they were just a very talented group. The reason they didn't do more is because they were based in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So they had to drive 500 miles just to get started.
Right.
And mainly they worked mostly the Midwest. They did a lot of gospel church dates out there, but they also worked a lot of country music dates along with Grand Ole Opry people. They would sing songs like Down by the Riverside or songs that were kind of generic. They weren't hardcore country, but they weren't gospel. Mm-hmm. And they didn't sing in the East much, and therefore a lot of people in the Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina didn't know who they were.
Right. And that's really a shame, because they could hold their own with anybody. If you go back and listen to a lot of their recordings, they're very solid.
If I want to hear some intricate arrangements of quartet singing that'll just really shock you, I'll pull a Plainsmen album out and listen to them sing some of those songs, the arrangements that they did. I mean, no one today is even attempting to sing like that.
All right, that brings me to my next question. I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you could point to one single group that had the best overall complete package, who would that group be?
Well, from my point of view, it was the Happy Goodman family.
I almost suspected that was coming.
Well, I mean, that's... I worked with them for 10 years altogether, and part of the time that I was working with them, Vestal was out.
Right.
And one of the albums that they did called the Happy Goodman Family Hour was recorded by the three Goodman brothers and a man named Johnny Cook, and Vestal did not appear on that album at all.
Right.
And there was a time when we were playing performances where it was a male quartet. It was no lady there.
Right.
And people don't really understand that. And I can play that album today, and it'll sound to me as good as any male quartet that's singing out there today.
Right. You know, during your time with the Happy Goodman family, that group got to do a lot of things that a lot of other groups never had the opportunity. For example, they had their own television show for a little while. But they got to appear on such things as the Dinah Shore show. And there was another show that I think they were on. Maybe the...
Well, it's interesting that you bringing that up, because I just recently went into my catalog of material at home and found a VHS video cassette, of the Happy Goodman family when they sung on a PBS special that was hosted by Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Wow.
And I went and made a DVD copy of it so I can play it on the computer now or play it on my DVD player. And I watched it just recently. The Tennessee Ernie Ford had a PBS special that included Della Reese, a black female singer. She eventually was on Touched by an Angel TV show.
Right.
She was on the program. A young lady named Mickey Furman, which she was a nice singer, but I don't think her career ever took off. And the Happy Goodman family. It was done at the Grand Ole Opry House at what was then Opryland. And a guy named Bill Walker was the music conductor for the orchestra. So I pulled that and watched it, and my wife watched it. And after, this was like 1978 or 79, and far as we're concerned, they still had the energy and the spirit in their singing.
Yeah, let's go back to the Dinah Shore show very quickly.
Dinah Shore, we did that show twice. We did it in Hollywood at a, I forget the name of the studio out there where they did, anyway. And then we also did the Dinah Shore show. She did a group of shows in Miami Beach. And we were down there and was on that also. But the one in Hollywood was the one that was the most fun.
So let me ask a question. How does a Southern gospel group get on the Dinah Shore show? What transpired to make that happen?
Well, my recollection is based upon the, at the time, the popularity of the Happy Goodman family.
Right.
At the time, they were pretty well the most popular group in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that kind of trickles out to the world, you know, somewhat. And plus, Rusty Goodman, which was one of my heroes, I mean, singer, songwriter, just a great guy, he didn't have any reservations. He didn't mind talking to anybody and say, you need to have the Happy Goodman family on your show. I mean, he might have called up the people that produced Dinah Shore, for all I know. But I'm just saying that sometimes you just call up and say, hey, we'd like to do your show. Okay. And then other people, they just don't have that kind of nerve or, you know.
Right. Sometimes you don't get because you don't ask.
That's correct.
So, you know, the Happy Goodman family undoubtedly have left a huge impact on gospel music. But a lot of people forget the fact that not only did the Happy Goodman family have a dynamic front line, their band was, well, second to none. You know, the band knew exactly what they were doing. For every bit of strength that the front line brought, the band brought additional strength, their own strengths. And you got to play with some incredible players along the way.
No question. We had, I feel like, the best, at the time, musicians, the best band. A lot of other people had musicians that played with them. And a lot of times they measure up the band, you know, value sometimes or how they play or how good they are. They measure that up because they like the group that they're playing with.
Right.
Well, you know, if you liked group A over here and that was your favorite group, then the band was the best. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
The Happy Goodman Family band, if you weren't a Happy Goodman Family fan, you probably didn't think their band was all that good. But from a musician standpoint and one who's played in so many recording sessions and played with so many musicians and professionals of Nashville, I can tell you that the Happy Goodman Family band was pro all the way. And they knew when to play and when not to play.
Right.
And they knew when to sell it and not to sell it.
And that's sometimes knowing when to back out a little bit is way more important than knowing when to go out front sometimes.
Well, they were all a team, and I kind of wanted to keep them, you know, if we were doing a song that was, you know, required everybody quieting down, we quieting down. And when you can even hear the acoustic guitar playing. One of the best compliments I ever remember getting with the Happy Goodman family as far as the music was concerned was some guy came out, you know, at intermission, was talking. He said, y'all sound like a recording. And to me, that was about the ultimate compliment because he meant it in a great way that
exactly
we were that smooth, that well played, and that was a very good compliment.
Yeah. You know, one more thing about the Happy Goodman family before we move on. You told me this one time a few years ago you know, in every group, you've at least today, you have one person that's somewhat dictating what's going on at the stage at that moment. You know, one person calls the songs, one person kind of sets the program, if you will. The Happy Goodman family, if I recall what you told me correctly, even though they had an idea of what they wanted to do each program, anybody on the front line, if they needed to change something, it was just go for it type mentality. You know, it's, we're going to do what the moment calls for. And that was one of the things that made the Happy Goodman family so well received. They let the audience tell them where they wanted to go.
Well, that's true. We would have sort of an idea of what the program consists of. Mm-hmm. When you have as many hit songs as they had, I mean, you know, it's like you were referring earlier to the McCamies had to sing God on the Mountain. Well, there were certain songs that the Happy Goodman family have to sing because that's what the people expect.
Right.
So there were certain songs that were into the program that had to be done. Then there were other songs that were, you know, built around that. But if Howard Goodman felt in his heart that we needed to sing X, then he spoke up and we sang X.
Right.
If Vestal says, you know, I feel like God's wanting me to sing this, then the band played it. I mean, it wasn't hunting it on a machine.
Right. Y'all just rolled out the key and went.
We played it. Yeah. And that was part of the spontaneity of it all that also helped create some of that, what the audience really liked.
Yeah. Do you have an all-time favorite Happy Goodman family song?
Well, that's a loaded question.
Well, I know. But I kind of led you down that path.
Well, there's so many. There's so many. Rusty's got so many great songs
right.
that he's written Who Am I, you know, and Had It Not Been, and a song called How Much More. But, you know, What a Beautiful Day for the Lord to Come Again is probably my favorite. And because I was a co-writer on it, maybe. But if I weren't the co-writer on it, if you play the original recording of it, it just got the magic to it.
Right. It's a great cut. It really is a great song.
What's so funny, Danny, is that if you go on the internet right now and you type in What a Beautiful Day and try to play it by the Happy Goodman family, you'll get a recut, which is Vestal, Howard, and Sam, and Rusty doing two parts. The original What a Beautiful Day cut is not on the internet. I'm going to try to do something about that soon because I have the album with the original cut, which is Howard, Sam, Rusty, and Johnny Cook.
Right.
So that's probably my favorite Happy Goodman family song.
You're listening to Danny's Diary, podcast powered by Singing News Magazine. And if you are not a subscriber to Singing News Magazine, we can help you with that. Simply dial 800-527-5226, and you can keep up with everything that is going on in the world of gospel music. If it has anything at all to do with Southern gospel, there's a good chance you're going to find it in the Singing News Magazine. You can also check singingnews.com. Our guest today is Eddie Crook, producer, songwriter, performer, a little bit of everything. Of course, his forte is piano, and Eddie Crook's name comes up many times when you ask piano players of today who influenced them along the way. So it's only fair turnabout that we ask Eddie Crook who influenced him during his days at the keyboard.
Well, as far as gospel music is concerned, I would say that one person that influenced me the most was Jackie Marshall, who played for a while with the Blackwood Brothers. And when he quit playing, a guy named Wally Varner came and played. And two little different styles there, but they both had that ability to play the runs up and down the keyboard, which was popular back then, and people enjoyed hearing, and I liked it, and I guess the Jackie Marshall and Wally Varner are the two. And, of course, I picked up stuff from everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, but as far as the gospel side, that would be primarily the ones that had the most influence on me. If you go over just piano alone and not limited to gospel music, I have to bring in Liberace, which people that's on listening to you may have heard about him, may not have heard about him. He was around for a long time. He's no longer with us, and he had a lot of issues and a lot of things that people don't care for. But if I want to hear some good piano playing, flawless, it doesn't matter if it's classical or if it's boogie-woogie, I put on a Liberace album and listen to it.
All right. In the same vein, I don't think we've ever asked anyone a question about equipment, Troy. Our engineer today, Troy Peach, by the way, he is the host of Southern Nights on Singing News Radio Network, and he also sings part-time with the Perrys. That's the way he looks at it some days. But anyway, Troy, I don't think we've ever asked this question that I'm about to pose to Eddie Crook. Eddie, in your opinion, what's the best piano out there?
Well, that's a loaded question, but as far as I'm concerned, there's only three: Steinway, Baldwin, and Yamaha. Now, there's others, but those are the main major three for me.
Okay.
But Steinway is not built like it was built back in the 40s, 50s. Baldwin is not built like it was back in the 40s and 50s. The Yamaha is probably not built like it was, but those three would be my favorite pianos. And I qualify that because you can find a great Steinway somewhere, and you can find a Steinway that's not so great. You can find a Baldwin somewhere that's great, and you can find a Yamaha somewhere that's great, and you can find pianos that are not so great. Here again, it depends on each pianist. I go by the touch, the feel of the keyboard, the tone of the bass, the clarity of the timbre of the treble. There's various factors I listen to, but primarily it comes down to the feel of it, the touch. Mm-hmm. I remember playing on a Steinway Grand in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania one time when it was before the Goodmans, I believe it was somebody else, but played with a Couriers Quartet in Pennsylvania at a big concert hall there. It was about a 9-foot Steinway. It was wonderful because it just played itself. The touch on it. So Steinway, Baldwin, Yamaha.
All right. Speaking of that, back during the days of your travels, you often had to rely on whatever piano happened to be in the venue at the time. And I feel like there's probably some nervous moments that have transpired along the way. When the bus would roll in, you'd walk to the stage and find a piano. And did you ever go, "Oh my"?
Well, we did more than "Oh my." we encountered the worst and the best, and we would do a lot of dates together with other groups, you know. And I remember the guy that played with the Gold City. He played with the Dixie Echoes for a while before that, I think.
Gary Jones.
And we would play some dates together, and we'd run up on this piano, you know, there that was, it might make good stove wood, but that's about all it would make, kindling. And we would laugh and talk about it, but hey, you played it. That's all you had at the time. And then there'd be other pianos, you know, that some of the keys would stick. Some of them were broken. And even though the singing groups, they all had these booking agents, you know, that booked them. And in their contract, it says the piano will be tuned to A440. But it didn't say that the piano would play. Maybe two or three of the keys were in A440.
But not the other 80-something.
But if you know, most of the time it was bad. I mean, we had some bad ones. We'd have a good one every now and then. But most of the time it was bad. But you just dealt with it. You play around whatever you got, you know. And then there came a time with the Happy Goodman family when Rusty got tired of it. he, well, the Goodmans, I guess he was responsible. They bought a electric grand. That's what they called it, a baby grand, I guess, electric. And that thing weighed a ton. But it was consistent. It always played the same, sounded the same every night. But it take a couple of guys to bring it in, set it up, you know. So they overcame the bad piano with that. And then after that, it went from piano to pre-recorded music.
Yeah. Well, now with all the history that you have in gospel music, you're certainly a qualified individual who can answer our final question today. As you see it today, what does gospel music need for the proverbial shot in the arm? What would be the best thing to happen to gospel music right now?
That's a hard question because I've pondered that myself many times and wonder if I were starting the way I started back many years ago, what would I do? How would I address everything? And it's a problem. It's a puzzle what to do. I still believe it matters about the song more than it does the singer. I believe it matters about the singers finding the songs and just singing them in the simplicity of it and not worry about having a large orchestra player behind them or large choral singing behind them. I think the audience will buy just simplicity, singing from the heart and singing with the spirit and having the right song. And that's why I would encourage people to do that and just try it. But the thing about it is, that's not exciting to some of our singers because they just can't seem to get it down to that simple level. I've got to have that big track behind me. I've got to have this other stuff. But if you've got the right song and you can sing it with the sincerity and the spirit, the audience will grab onto it. They don't care about the choral group or the big orchestra. They don't care about it. They care about you meaning what you're singing, believing what you're singing, and singing a song that's going to touch them that they can relate to. That's my belief.
Our guest today has been Eddie Crook, a legend from the world of Southern gospel music. You have been listening to Danny's Diary. Be watching for our next episode. Keep checking singingnews.com.